It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
It's your host, Ashley Lana, your certified nightmare prescriber and your giver of nightmares. I haven't said that one in a while, but I thought I would bring it back since I had a fear cult member tell me that they had a nightmare after listening to the Daniel LaPlante case. As long as you're able to psychologically bounce back from that, I'm very pleased and flattered that I was able to give you nightmares. And I hope my voice narrated the whole thing. Welcome back to the podcast. I adore you, my listeners. I can't express how much I truly appreciate every single one of you. You listen, you review, you tell me what you think of the episodes, and I love it. And when you tell me you have nightmares, oh, I love it. I love it so much. I don't get nightmares, so I kind of lack empathy with you in that kind of aspect. I know that's not true. I do suffer from nightmares, but when I do, I'm usually stuck in the middle of the ocean with nothing underneath me and the sun is setting. And as I turn my body and see what would be land, it's blue sky. And then as the current pulls me further out into the ocean, the sky is red and it's turning black as it gets closer to the water. I think it's because I don't have a father. Now, dream interpreters out there will probably say that it's my telling of future encounters. Now, as the owner of said nightmare, I'm here to tell you that it's because I get an adrenaline high from the body's natural fight or flight response. And although I'm not scared of much, I do have two phobias. So sometimes I will watch videos of my two phobias with the sole purpose to freak me out before bed. And then I'll go to sleep and I'll have the dream I just told you, and it scares the fucking hell out of me. I'll wake up sweating. But coming down from that, ugh, so good. So good. I've never done drugs in my life, but fucking nightmare highs, bruh. So here are my two phobias, okay? One, megalohydrothalassophobia, which is the immense fear of creatures or objects underwater, and specifically submechanophobia, which is the fear of submerged man-made machines, such as like planes, ships, submarines, large mechanical objects just being underneath me in water. I'm not scared of water. I love deep pools, lakes, and rivers, and I'm not scared of sharks or whales. Like, even if they were gonna kill me, like, that doesn't scare me. I'm scared of the fact that they're just simply underneath me when I'm in water. That is so scary. So if I had 100% confidence that nothing was there, I'm cool, fine, I'm good. Throw a boat on the seafloor? No. No. Hard no. It's such a specific fear because I'm not scared of heights. I'm not scared of deep water. So in my dreams, I'm carried off into the ocean by waves, with my brain wondering what shipwrecks and submarines are underneath me. That scares me. Serial killers, horror movies, and the paranormal? Water off a duck's back. So with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last episode, we discussed the 9-year-old serial killer, Caetano Santos Quirino, who was Argentina's first serial killer. This week's episode is a worst of the worst episode, and you can thank the Fear Cult on Instagram because I set up a poll asking if they wanted a worst of the worst episode or a lighter case, and they chose a wow episode, so we're all gonna get it. This case has stuck with me for years, and it doesn't get easier to think about. I can tell you the exact moment I read about the case. I was in the 8th grade, and I was having a sleepover at my friend's house. And both of us were both horror movie buffs, and we were watching Saw 2, which is my favorite franchise, but I digress. There was a torture scene, and then my friend goes, "Oh my god, have you heard about this crime story?" I hadn't heard about it, so she pulled up her laptop, and we're reading it at 1 in the morning. I was so fucking disturbed about what happens in this case. I was in the 8th grade and now I'm a grown adult and the case still makes me uncomfortable. So why would you do an episode that's so disturbing if it fucked you up? Here's why. I personally believe that it's important to recognize that these events happened and the victims in very horrific crimes deserve to be remembered and their stories told, because a lot of people won't tell the stories because they're so horrific and then people forget about them. And then the perpetrators' crimes are just swept under the rug. Now, criminal justice is very important to me. I respect the victims in the cases I tell, and I expect my listeners to respect them too. Fuck the criminals. Go to town on reaming those psychopaths out. They are certified fruitcakes, so go at her. But you always respect the victims. And this week's case is very, very graphic and disturbing, and I can't put a larger disclaimer on a WoW episode. This is a worst of the worst torture case. So, get comfortable. Because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of kidnapping, physical abuse, torture, rape, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Her dying body slugged across the hardwood floor toward the stairs, each bare hand slapping the wood on the floor as she pulled her body forward. The burns on her legs practically anchored her skin to the floor. Her movement was slow and weak. She heard the laughing of the boys in the other room, who just watched her struggle. It had been close to an hour and she had not even made it down the stairs. All she was trying to do was go to the washroom. The young girl finally reached the edge of the stairs, and looking down, she felt exhausted, knowing that she had to descend and eventually crawl back up. This was the journey she had to take every time she had to use the bathroom. Her body was broken, and her hope was the only thing keeping her going. She had been praying for someone to save her for the past 17 days. She was bracing her body to hit the first step and was prepared to slide down, but a hand grabbed around her ankle and pulled her screaming body back towards the bedroom. Her hand reached forward as if to grab for a savior's hand, but no one was there. The boy threw her against the wall and slammed the door. The sound of her screaming laced with the laughing of three evil boys filled the empty hallway. This was only the beginning. Day 17. Day 17 of 44. This is the horrific true story of Junko Furuta and her 44 days in hell. Junko Furuta was born January 18th, 1971. In Masato, Satama, Japan. She lived with her parents and her two brothers. Her parents could not have asked for a happier family. It was in 1988 when Junko attended Yashio Minami High School. She was the ideal picture of a popular teenager, a girl with good reputation. She was intelligent, confident, and had a beautiful smile that melted the hearts of everyone she encountered. Unlike her classmates, Junko didn't smoke, do drugs, or even drink. Her family thought the world of her. This perfect lifestyle, of course, attracted the eyes of more disreputable students who believed that Junko thought she was better than everyone else. One student in particular was Hiroshi Miyano, an 18-year-old boy who had fallen madly in love with Junko. Hiroshi Miyano was a school bully. He terrorized his classmates as well as his own parents. He was constantly showing off and embellishing his lifestyle to appear cooler than he really was. Hiroshi and his friends were suspended many times and eventually expelled. He claimed to be part of a local criminal organization called the Yakuza. The Yakuza are a violent organization similar to the Mafia that have been around for over 400 years. The members adopt samurai-like rituals and engage in extortion, prostitution, drug trafficking, as well as having heavy influences in businesses and factories throughout Japan. They are still active today and are involved in international criminal activity. The Yakuza are very interesting and definitely are entangled in criminal activity, despite that the Yakuza consider themselves a chivalrous organization because they donate to charities in times of need and the events of a natural disaster. Yet they are a very violent criminal organization. They do good deeds though. So the 1995 Kobe earthquake in Japan, for example, they were the first to aid more than 45,000 people who were left homeless. And they even sent Yakuza members to alleviate the nuclear reactor disaster of Fukushima in 2011. So they provide aid in many disaster events, which is great. From what I was able to research, the Yakuza were very dangerous and misunderstood. The organization itself has been around for over 400 years and started with Japan's social outcasts. These outcasts were called the Burakumin. They were considered unclean and the lowest of society to the point of not even being able to touch someone who was considered superior than them. The jobs they were allowed to take involved death, so executioners and undertakers. Dating back all the way to the 11th century of Japan, they had formal laws with the purpose of casting the Burakumin out of society completely. They could not get a job, their children were blacklisted and could not go to school, and they were even sent to live in secluded towns of just the Burakumin. Because of the immense segregation, they had to find ways to make money to support their families, and this is when they began setting up gambling shops and peddlers, which eventually grew into organized crime. They then grew into the Yakuza, and members have completely showed their loyalty to this group, and you can still find members today who have their bodies completely tattooed. It's really cool, actually. And so even today in 2022, there's lists of Burakumin descendants that are used to prevent them from entering certain jobs. They're still very feared in Japan. So going back to the chivalrous organization concept, the Yakuza have a code that they abide by, the Ninkyo code, which is a principle that every Yakuza claims to live by, which forbids members to allow anyone to suffer during times of crisis. Yet, they're known for being a violent crime organization. So, misunderstood is definitely a great word to describe the Yakuza, because I myself still don't completely understand. However, it's important to recognize the fear that the name brings in Japan. The Yakuza were never messed with, so when Hiroshi had affiliations with the group, people bowed to him in fear. He got away with whatever he wanted. Well, fucking bastard. So, are we all on the same page here? Same paragraph? Same paragraph, different sentence? Okay, good. Close enough. Let's go. It was outside of the classroom when Hiroshi Miyano decided he was going to ask Junko out on a date. Junko explained that she wasn't ready for dating and wanted to focus on her education. And although she was polite, Hiroshi was humiliated. No one ever said no to him. He took this rejection personally. It was at that moment he told his friends that he was going to have her kicking and screaming. It was on a chilly, dark night on the 25th of November when 18-year-old Hiroshi Miyano and his 16-year-old friend Nobuharu Minato were stalking the streets. The plan was to find a random woman to rape, and then rob her, leaving her in an alleyway. It was close to 11:30 p.m. when they seen a young girl riding her bicycle. As Hiroshi focused in on the girl, he smirked, and it turned sinister. It was Junko Furuta. She was on her way home from her part-time job at a plastic molding factory. Hiroshi instructed his friend on what to do next. Nobuharu then ran out into the bike path and kicked Junko to the pavement, her bike landing on top of her. Nobuharu then fled, leaving Hiroshi to emerge from the shadows to rescue her as if nothing had happened.
Ow. 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 Ow.
Hey.
Ow.
Are you okay?
Ow. I think so. Some person just kicked me off my bike.
I seen that. You sure you're all right?
Yeah. I'm okay. It's just a scrape. I'm fine. I've had worse.
You know, maybe I should walk you home.
Huh?
In case he comes back.
Hiroshi and Junko began walking under the neon street lamps down the street. Their destination was rerouted when Hiroshi told her that he knew a faster way. The two ended up at an abandoned warehouse. He then lured Junko inside and told her to shut up and listen. He explained that he was a dangerous person to have as an enemy. Hiroshi detailed the connections he had with the Yakuza, and if she did not do as he said, her entire family would be in grave danger. He then proceeded to rape her. Once he was done, he told her to go to a hotel with him that was located not far from the area. Hiroshi then raped Junko for the second time. Feeling a twisted sense of pride, he picked up the hotel phone and called his three friends. 16-year-old Nobuharu Minato, 17-year-old Yasushi Watanabe, and 17-year-old Joe Ogura. Joe Ogura asked Hiroshi if he could wait at the hotel until the three boys showed up, so they could take turns raping her. Together, the four boys had a violent history of gang-raping women, but were never punished. Prior to Junko Furuta's kidnapping, the gang had raped another girl, who they released, once they were finished with her, of course. It was close to 3 a.m. on November 26, 1988, when Hiroshi escorted Junko to a nearby park. There, they met with the three boys. From there, they walked to the gang's hangout, the house of Nobuharu. As they walked to the house, the boys went through her backpack, where they discovered her address and phone number. They repeatedly told her that if she tried to escape, they would kill her and kill her family. Once at the house of Nobuharu Minato, the four boys took turns raping Junko. The next day, on November 27th, Junko's parents called the police to file a missing persons report. However, the four boys knew that this would eventually happen. They forced Junko to call her parents and claim that she decided to run away and that she was safe. She told her parents to tell the police to call off the investigation. She didn't want to be found. The four teenage boys forced Junko to strip naked. They held her down and shaved her pubic hair. They made her parade around the room, and eventually they told her to stop, and they forced her to begin masturbating in front of them while she danced. They then threw cigarettes at her and laughed while degrading her. Frightened, Junko prayed that the humiliation would not last and that she could finally go home. All she had to do was do as she was told. Soon it would all be over. At least that's what they told her. This was only the beginning. Junko Furuta was just in the infancy of her 44 days in hell. Warning, the story gets very shocking and very graphic after this, so listener discretion is advised. The following events happened on days 1 to 11. It was nearing December in Japan, so the nights were crisp. Junko routinely awoke cold, naked, and alone on the second-story balcony of the Minato home. Throughout the day, the boys would drag her into the bedroom by her hair and take turns raping her. Hiroshi would invite members of the Yakuza over to help torture the poor girl. It is estimated that over the course of the 44 days, more than 100 men were invited to the house to participate in the brutal rape and torture of Junko. She was raped over 500 times. At one point, she was raped by 12 different men in a single day. When the guests would arrive, they would burn her with cigarette lighters and blowtorches. If she screamed, the men would beat her with golf clubs as they stood around her laughing. Once she was beaten to the point of weakness, they would command her to stand and dance for them. They would throw items at her until she started masturbating. If she fell over or whined, they would punish her more, even urinating on her body if she fell to the floor crying. The boys would turn on the lights in the bedroom and wait until the bulbs were hot. Putting on gloves, one of the boys would remove the scalding bulb and insert it into her vagina. This happened routinely. Days went by and the same tortures evolved into more horrific events. Various objects were forced into her vagina and anus, including knives, scissors, skewers, and glass bottles. The boys would light fireworks off in her ears that damaged her eardrum so bad that she could barely hear. When she would not hear an order, they would beat her more. Junko was not given any food, and her only substance was the cockroaches on the floor. And the only thing they gave her to drink were cups of urine and semen provided by her captors. Between the days of day 11 and day 19, the daily rapes continued. They were beating her with iron rods, fireworks were now getting inserted and set off inside of her mouth, vagina, and anus. The hot light bulbs were getting pushed into her vagina with the intent of the hot glass exploding internally. Eventually it did. By this point, the parents of Nobuharu Minato knew that Junko was not the girlfriend of one of the gang members. They were fully aware that the poor girl was kidnapped and being abused, yet they did nothing. The family knew that if they told the authorities, then they faced the wrath of the Yakuza, and they feared their son, so they never told a soul. Roughly around day 14, Junko begged for her captors to let her go. She told them that she promised that she would never tell and that their secret was safe. The four boys said the same thing every time. You will be free, but for now, shut up, or we will kill you and your family. Junko became extremely malnourished, and they forced her to drink milk, alcohol, and water in such large quantities that she would involuntarily vomit them back up. Her stomach was just beginning to start rejecting food and liquids. Junko began rebelling to the constant raping by men. It was irritating to Hiroshi, so he doused her legs and arms in lighter fluid, and he lit her on fire until she promised to stop fighting. Then the rape would continue. The boys would progress their tortures to entertain their friends. They would tie Junko up by her wrists to the ceiling, and they would take turns punching her body like a punching bag. When the men decided to cut her down, Hiroshi would then tie her limbs spread on the floor, and together, the boys would drop heavy dumbbells onto her stomach and limbs. How's everyone doing so far? I thought I would give you this moment to kind of adjust because the case is going to get harder, and this poor girl goes through hell. It is a true crime story that is not commonly discussed due to the graphic extent of the crimes, because these boys were control, power, motivated criminals. They got their pleasure in controlling victims through suffering. And I wasn't able to find a specific criminal background on the four boys, other than they were involved in gang rapes and assaults. I did not find any previous cases of murder, but I wouldn't rule that out. However, innocent until proven guilty, unfortunately. Hiroshi and his friends could be considered process-focused, so their satisfaction came from the prolonged suffering of their victims, specifically in the case of Junko. Criminologists subcategorize process-focused killers into two types. There's hedonistic lust killers and power control killers. Psychology Today explains that power control criminals will sexually assault their victims. However, unlike hedonistic criminals, the rape is not motivated by lust. Control seekers have a primary motive to dominating and controlling their victims. So with the boys, it definitely seemed as though their ringleader, Hiroshi Miyano, in the case of Junko Furuta, was initially motivated by lust because the two went out to rape a random woman. But when Hiroshi seen that the girl on the bicycle was Junko, the girl that turned him down, it turned into a revenge control. You said I couldn't have you, now let me dominate you in a horrific way. Lust was definitely involved, especially for the other three. Like the other three boys, it was kind of a tag along and they were wanting to rape and torture her, but not to get back at her. And that's what Hiroshi was doing. Hiroshi wanted to prolong her suffering. Now, it's an interesting breakdown because criminologists understand that if criminals kill quickly and they do not prolong the process of murder, then the act is the term called act-focused killing. Their point would be to find their victim, kill them quickly, moving on. These guys had a prolonged torture on Junko. So we are going to continue on now. Buckle up, we're going on a ride. One night, Junko decided that she had to find an escape. She found the courage to try to pick her body up and sneak out of the building, but she didn't succeed. Hiroshi and his friends dragged her back upstairs screaming. They poured lighter fluid on her legs and lit her on fire. Her body would go into shock and she would fall into seizures. The boys always thought she was faking, so they would douse the fire out. And then when she awoke, they would beat her with bamboo sticks and set her limbs on fire again. They burned her eyelids, vagina, and clitoris with lighters. Hiroshi would force her eyelids open and have another pour hot wax directly into her eyes. After, they kept her in a freezer for hours to cool her off. Her face was held on a cement floor, where men would jump on her head until she would pass out, waking her up by urinating on her face or lighting her on fire. Junko's injuries were officially making living a struggle. She developed a blood clot in her nose, which blocked her nasal cavity. The ritualistic punishments caused such severe bleeding that her stomach was not digesting food. This would cause her to vomit anything that entered her system. When she puked, the boys forced her to eat it, and then continued to beat her more. As days passed, nearing day 20, the boys pierced her breasts with sewing needles and eventually cut one of her nipples off completely and mutilated the other with a pair of pliers. There was no separation of the anus and her vagina, They cut into her with a pair of scissors, and she was profusely bleeding. Having so many injuries on her body made standing nearly impossible unless assisted. When she would go to the washroom, she would have to crawl on her stomach and drag her legs behind her. The process exceeded an hour. One day, Junko managed to crawl to the phone. She picked up the receiver and dialed the police. Before she could speak, one of the boys disconnected the call, dragging her back into the bedroom. They raped her and beat her with iron rods and pulled out all of her fingernails, one at a time. Rounding day 25 of 44, Junko was unrecognizable. Her face was swollen and her body was burned and bruised. Her hands were completely smashed, so she could no longer attempt to crawl to the bathroom. At this point, she lost all control of her bowel movements as a result of the dumbbells being constantly dropped on her pelvis. When she would urinate or defecate by accident, the boys would beat her more. The wounds on her body had become infected, and the rotting odor was overwhelming to the boys that the four of them stopped raping her. The boys decided that since they did not want to rape Junko anymore, they would have to find another victim. Later that week, Hiroshi and his friends kidnapped and raped a 19-year-old woman who was on her way home from work. After they finished with her, they let her free, threatening her life if she went to the police. Around day 30 of 44, Junko stopped urinating completely. Her hearing was practically gone due to the repeated insertion of firecrackers. She was left in the bedroom unable to move on the floor. When she would feel someone kick hard into her torso, then she knew someone was there. At one point, this event actually happened, and Junko weakly began begging him to kill her and end her suffering. The boy just left the room. The continuous trauma to her skull received from the boys jumping on her head caused her brain to shrink from the lack of circulation. On day 40 of 44, Junko begged one last time for her captors to kill her, and to quote, get it over with. Still, the gang of four did nothing. And on January 1st, 1989, Junko was left immobilized on the cold cement floor, greeting New Year's Day alone. It was now day 44, the final day in hell, on January 4th, 1989. Hiroshi and his three friends were downstairs playing a game of mahjong. The result of Hiroshi losing sent him into a fit of rage. Rather than taking it out on an object in the room, he wanted to use Junko. Taking lighter fluid, they poured it over her body and lit her on fire. Junko made small attempts to douse the fire, but failed and became unresponsive. The four boys began kicking and punching to wake her up. The beating lasted 2 hours and Junko didn't move. The four boys then left the room. Later that day, 17-year-old Junko Furuta died of her injuries. Less than 24 hours later, Junko's dead body was discovered by Nobuharu's brother, who was visiting. He called his brother and told him the news. Nobuharu began panicking and called Hiroshi, Yasushi, and Joe Ogura Kamisaku. The four were scared of getting caught with the murder of Junko Furuta. Together, the boys beat her body to the point where they could shrink it into a blanket. Her limbs were wrapped in plastic to prevent any bodily fluids from making a mess. Hiroshi and his friends were able to put her body into a steel drum, and they filled it with wet concrete. Once the mixture had solidified around 8 p.m. that night, they were able to put the barrel into a cement truck and dispose of the drum in Tokyo. On January 23rd, 1989, Hiroshi Miyano and Joe Ogura Kamisaku were arrested for the rape of the 19-year-old woman they had previously kidnapped and raped back in December. The two boys became highly paranoid about the murder of Junko, but kept quiet until they were released. It wasn't until March 29th in 1989 when two officers went to the homes of the two criminals. At the locations, they found multiple pairs of women's underwear and clothing. The two boys were taken into police interrogation separately. Hiroshi Miyano believed that the officers had known about the murder of Junko due to their ability to question the evidence. He thought that Joe Ogura Kamisaku had already confessed to the police and they were testing him, when in fact, they had no idea. The police were very confused once Hiroshi began confessing. Initially, the police wanted to know about the murder of a different woman and her 7-year-old child. The case of the mother and child to this day remains unsolved. On March 30th, 1989, the police located the concrete barrel filled with Junko's body. The top of the barrel had black hair exposed out of the top. The forensics team were able to remove the body from the concrete and test the fingerprints. They identified the body as 17-year-old Junko Furuta. Hiroshi Minato, Joe Agura Kamisaki, Yasushi Watanabe, and Nobuhiro Minato were immediately arrested. Once the DNA inside of Junko's body was tested, several other men were arrested and charged with sexual assault. Because the four boys were all underage, their identities were hidden from the public, and their names were changed at the time of the trial. The media were able to identify the names of the four criminals and actually expose them due to the monstrosities of their crimes towards Junko. They felt that they deserved to be published. When the crimes were detailed in the court, many people fainted, Junko's mother included. She had to undergo years of therapy to deal with her loss. All four boys pled guilty to reduce the charge to committing bodily injury that resulted in death of Junko Furuta. And this is where you guys are going to flip your fucking shit, okay? The ringleader of the crime, Hiroshi Miyano, was sentenced to 17 years in prison. When he attempted to appeal his charge, the judge added on another 3. The 20-year sentence is not life in prison. He was considered a minor. He was not given the death sentence or life in prison. Hiroshi's mother had to pay $425,000 in compensation for his crimes. In 2004, Hiroshi was refused parole. Then in 2013, after he was released, he was arrested for fraud, but due to insufficient evidence, he was released. Hiroshi Miyano is currently free. Nobuhiro Minato, the boy whose house Junko was held captive in, was sentenced to 5 to 9 years in prison. His brother and his parents were not charged with the involvement of knowing Junko was held captive in their house. He served 7 years in prison and was released. In 2018, Nobuhiro was arrested for assaulting a man with a steel rod and slitting his throat. He denied the claims of slitting his throat and claimed that he only stabbed him. The man did not die, but Nobuhiro was charged with assault and attempted murder. Nobuhiro Minato is currently free. Yasushi Watanabe was sentenced to 5 to 7 years in prison and served 7 years. Yasushi Watanabe is currently free. Joe Agura Kamisaku was sentenced to 8 years in juvenile prison. While incarcerated, he bragged to his friends and other inmates about what he did to Junko and how he helped kill her. He was released in 2004. 5 years later, Joe Agura Kamisaku was arrested for physically assaulting a jealous love rival. He tracked him down and beat the 27-year-old man and threw him in the back of his car. He drove him to another location and continued to beat him for hours on end, threatening to kill him, and that he had killed before and knew how to get away with it. He was sentenced to 7 more years in prison. The man who Joe Agura Kamisaku threatened told the court that the offender said, quote, "I have killed before, and I know how to get away with it. And I will kill you." Joe Agura Kamisaku is currently free. That is the horrific true crime story of the murder of Junko Furuta and her 44 days of torture. That case is not for the faint of heart, and it's difficult to read the case reports on it and seeing how long she had to go through that. 44 days is a long fucking time to have everything that happened to her happen every day. And she did not deserve what happened to her. The standards of the Japanese juvenile justice system should have been reevaluated, especially after that case, because those four boys, they did not learn anything for what they did. Only one of them didn't get back into the life of crime, and Junko suffered injustice and her attackers got off easy. 2019 marked the 30th anniversary of her death, and from what I was able to sadly conclude, Japan doesn't particularly remember Junko. I'm assuming the monstrosities of the crime are probably reason, because everything I just told you, the public doesn't want to acknowledge that that stuff happens, especially if the criminal attackers are walking down the street, right? And it's tough. It's really tough. I think she should be remembered. So that's why I'm doing this case. There is, however, an action manga and a Japanese independent horror film based on the crime, both released in 2004. The film is called Concrete and I will not attempt to pronounce and butcher the name of the manga. I cannot do that. So the film Concrete, I watched it years ago, and you know, I might actually rewatch it after I'm done this, because I remember it was good. It was an independent film, and you felt as though you were there, and it's so sadistic that I just said that I'm gonna watch it again. But again, I watch it for a different reason. I don't watch it for the gore and the horror. I watch it more or less for the memory. And I think it's important to remember that this girl lived, and as sad as her story is, it happened. And she deserves to be recognized as a very strong young girl who had a bright future that was taken away from her because of four disgusting monsters who were not stopped. Like, look at pictures of Junko. She is so beautiful. She has the happiest smile, and she's got the biggest cheeks, and she's so pretty. Like, she had everything going for her. And I will not forget who she was. And now you all know her story, and I hope that you never forget who she was and what she went through. So may she rest in peace. On a lighter note, the voice cameo during this episode belongs to the sultry Mictorious from the Ask the Fellows podcast. And I'm laughing because that came out a lot more sultry than I expected. I've been friends with him and the fellows for a long time now, so I thought I would ask him to lend his vocal cords for my podcast. So thank you, Mick.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
I'm going to do something a little different on our never-ending quest this week. The WoW episode, Worst of the Worst, was not for the faint of heart. So I'm going to recommend a comedy horror movie, which is actually one of my favorites. It's funny because when I first watched this movie, I was with the same friend who told me about the Junko case back in the 8th grade. Her dad got to pick the film that we were going to watch, and we were so pissed because it looked so stupid to two teenage girls. And then we really hated ourselves because the movie wasn't even 20 minutes in and we really liked it. And we had to put our pride aside and be like, fuck, you chose a good movie. It's one of the best comedy horror movies I've ever seen in my entire life. Probably one of the best comedy movies I've actually seen in my entire life. I will say that. That is a big freaking shoe to fill, but I'm gonna say it. It's my opinion, I can do it. And it's the 2010 horror comedy Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. This movie is hilarious. The premise of the movie is two hillbillies buy a rundown cabin to renovate as their fishing summer house, and at the same time, a group of privileged, ignorant college students mistake them for a pair of serial killers, and shit just hits the fan. It has the moral of perception, and that perception is everything, and not to judge a book by its cover. So I'm not going to give it away, but there is this one scene with a wood chipper and a chainsaw, and the lead up is just too funny. Now, a lot of you are probably going to say yes, but have you watched the movie Dodgeball? If so, the guy who plays Steve the Pirate is one of the main characters, and he is so funny. And the YouTube horror recommendation this week is also on a lighter side. It's called Make Me a Sandwich. It's an interesting concept, so check it out. I will post the video link on Twitter and Instagram. Now, Fear Cult, I want to introduce you to a new true crime podcast that I've been listening to. It's called Rogue Darkness, and it's hosted by Raven. She specializes in true crime stories that are committed under the misunderstandings of the occult and witchcraft, which have resulted in grim and gruesome events. So here is a sneak peek of Rogue Darkness.
Witchcraft, the occult, extremist beliefs, murder. Tune in to Rogue Darkness each Friday and join host Raven as I uncover horrific crimes committed under the misconceptions and misunderstandings of witchcraft and other belief systems. I'll cover a wide range of crimes involving ritualistic killings and extremist beliefs to cult persuasion and supposed possession. Anything and everything that borders the line of horrifying. There's always three sides to a story. Side A, side B, and then the truth. Let's uncover the truth together and explore the darkness of mankind, one crime at a time. Available wherever you get your podcast fix, simply by searching Rogue Darkness.
So, as your certified nightmare prescriber, I recommend you get addicted to Rogue Darkness. Check out the 2010 horror comedy Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, watch the horror short, make me a sandwich, and listen to Rogue Darkness. I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. Please rate and review. Follow Lullaby the Fear Podcast on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Slasher, and Instagram at Lullaby the Fear Podcast. Join the fear cult there. Thank you so much for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.